Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition, available April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
For more in-depth perspectives and interesting stories, sign up for our daily newsletter at tvo.org/daily.
The agenda this week considered how policing might evolve, checked in with American expats after the U.S. presidential debate, and heard the case for citizens helping to bolster democracy. The agenda's week in review begins with a challenge that COVID-19 presents to city living.
Not everyone agrees there's an urban exodus happening. Here's what urbanist Richard Florida had to say back in an article in July. It reads, "We've only seen a movement out of three cities, New York, Boston, and Detroit. We've seen nothing of this in Toronto. There has been no massive exodus of people out of Toronto into the suburbs over and above the family formation moves we've seen before. What we're likely to see is far less a disruption or a recasting of trends and far more an acceleration of change that is already underway." Now, that was an article, Richard Florida, in the National Post in July. Mary, what do you think of Richard's argument?
Well, I think he's right. But I would also say this, you know, Richard lives in Toronto, but he's an American. A lot of his data sources are American, as you can see, and he's citing three American cities where they have cell phone data to suggest people have left. But the history of American cities has been of an exodus, predominantly driven by race and income historically over decades. And so there's a different pattern there, I think, that could potentially, and I think Americans are wise to watch this, it could potentially start to replicate. But I think we need to be clear that it's more of a pattern of mobility in American cities to have a vacation home that you go to on the weekends. We don't have that in Toronto to the same extent. We have people that have vacation homes and go in the summer, like to their cottage. But we don't have the same pattern where a whole block after block after block to camp every weekend. So I think it's a different demographic pattern. I also think that Torontonians take seriously their commitment to being in their place 24/7. We've made a livable city. Melissa refers to this. People have invested in making this a 24/7, 7-day-a-week city. So I don't think we have the same issue. What I want to respond to John, if I may, that as much as John is suggesting that, you know, that young family that's been living in a small condo and just had a baby and they're about to have a second one, they were going to be looking to get out anyway. They were going to look to make that transition. That's just a lifestyle decision that lots and lots of families make. The difference is that usually we have immigration and we have lots of people coming in to easily take up that space. And so the numbers don't necessarily reflect just exodus because there's people coming in. And I still think that's happening. And I don't know how your data can track that, John. Obviously, immigration isn't, but that's going to resettle itself. We'll see immigration, I'm sure, turning. And John, I'm interested whether your data is going to be able to show this, because you, I'm sure you'll tell us that residential home, single family homes at the moment are actually still in bidding wars in Toronto. So somebody is coming and wanting to live here. And my guess is it may be some of those condo dwellers where a decision was kind of in the back of their mind, we better think about this, and now they're going to take advantage of the market and they're going to buy a house now. So I don't think it's, I just don't think it's cut or dried. I do think there are profound challenges for us in terms of rethinking the configuration of spaces generally, in terms of the supply that's going to come on next. And what does condo life need to look like that allows more space, more shared space, more public space, and can be safer? Because we have neighborhoods across the city where people are in apartments that are too small, where they are overcrowded, and where they have not been able to be safe either from the virus or from the domestic challenges of living in cramped space. So I think that's a profound challenge for city builders and people in John's industry to think seriously, how are they going to change that?
With that, I'm going to let John respond. What do you make of Richard's argument that there hasn't been a massive exodus as well?
You know, to some extent, he's right in the sense that we're for sure seeing a bit of an exodus from low-rise homes in the city, so families that have semis, to the outer suburbs, but it is not a mass exodus. You know, there are still bidding wars in Toronto. City of Toronto is still a very booming city. So the low-rise home market is not materially impacted by this. You know, these are probably hundreds of families that are moving out of the city. And because a lot of these really outer suburban areas, don't have a lot of sales, proportionately, they have a big increase in sort of the number of people competing on those homes. So I tend to agree that that is not the biggest factor. But the big factor that I think he misses in his argument is that we're definitely seeing an exodus out of cities. And it is not just people who are upsizing from condos. Those are people who own their condos and are moving. So the big exodus really that we're finding are the people who are renting condominiums who are moving out of them. And the rents in Toronto have dropped about 20% downtown over last year. And this is not necessarily due to a big decline in demand. Rental demand has been roughly the same as last year, despite the fact that immigration's lower. It's really driven by this surge in supply, and the surge in supply is because a really high number of people are just moving out of their units, partly because they can't afford them, partly because they're no longer walking to work and their micro condo is no longer big enough for them to live and work out of. So these are the big trends that I think that are impacting the city of Toronto right now.
Do you think, generally speaking, we ask the police to do too much?
Absolutely. I think that police officers are going into situations that they don't have the proper training for. In many instances, dealing with those individuals who are suffering with mental health issues or addictions issues, other life issues that aren't generally in the purview of police officer duties or shouldn't be. They currently are. And there are things, as the chief said, that police officers need to do and only police officers can do. In the last 4 months, we've had a lot of talk about defunding police and limiting what they do and using some of the police budget to fund other agencies to do things that they should be doing. We haven't seen any substantive change in any police force across Canada. They're still trying to maintain the sphere of influence that they have.
Fareeda, I'll go to you next. We have, as Chad rightly just suggested, we've heard efforts to have the police reformed. We've heard efforts to have the police defunded. We've even had, in some circumstances, efforts to have the police abolished entirely. Which path are you inclined to be on?
You know, I think from our perspective, when we're talking about dealing with what's happening to the Black community and the Indigenous community in terms of Black death, the loss of Black life, I think the Black Legal Action Center is closer to the spectrum of transforming the policing as we know it in this province. So that does include defunding the police, meaning taking resources away from the police and investing them in agencies who may be better equipped to do. And I think part of that also includes reimagining police. So it's not just about militarizing. It's not about dismantling. It's also about thinking about our relationship with each other and getting to the roots of how we address things like crime. What are our concepts of justice? What are our concepts of fairness? And so, yeah, from the Black Legal Action's perspective, it's a robust conversation, but we definitely adhere to the defund position.
Kwasi, maybe you could follow up on that and help us understand what we mean, because I have certainly heard activists say we need to defund the police as a means of punishing them. In other words, taking away responsibilities from them. On the other hand, I have heard the expression defund the police used, meaning the police just are not the best people to carry out this function. And therefore, we need to take that money not to punish police, but to more appropriately spend it on others who can better perform those tasks. Help us understand what your understanding of what all of this means.
Well, I think we're hearing all of the things that you've said and more. And I particularly appreciate a term that one of my colleagues kind of lended to me, which is actually detasking the police. I think, you know, what we've acknowledged that is that the police are doing too much and that their budgets reflect that. And we want to take away some of those tasks. And importantly, we know that when we have the police engage in activities that they're not the best organization or institution to engage in, we have a number of negative consequences that might flow from that. One being the criminalization of people that might not otherwise be criminalized. So we can think about this in the context of homelessness with respect to drug use when we've got police in schools, but also, of course, in relation to the use of force as well. So I particularly like, I'm using the term and in the work that I'm doing in the area, use de-tasking the police, which recognizes that we're going to, you know, take some of the tasks away from the police, and that there will be a corresponding reduction in the police budget to go along with that. And this isn't new. This has been acknowledged by the Canadian Associations of Chiefs of Police. This has been acknowledged by the Canadian government and in other Western nations long before the current conversations around defunding the police emerged as they have now.
Chief Williams, given the way that it has just been described by Akwasi, are you on side with that kind of transformation?
Well, I love the word detask. And, you know, our last speaker was quite correct that it has been discussed about at the CACP level and in the Ontario Association of Chiefs of Police level provincially. And, you know, mental health is a really good example of a file that the police did not ask for. But again, as the only, quite often the only 24/7 response, it falls into our lap. And we have said for a number of years that police are not always the appropriate agency to respond to many of these calls. With adequate support from the provincial level, then maybe these calls wouldn't come to us in the first place. But as it sits right now, many of these calls for service, from what we hear through our community partners, you know, there is still a role for the police often to attend in some capacity. Not always, but often there is. And that doesn't necessarily mean it has to be a police-led response, though.
You know, from my perspective, it is possible for him to win, but I don't like to imagine that reality because I think that, like I said, I think democracy in the United States will collapse as we know it. I think it's important, though, to point out that the presidential office is not the only one on the ballot right now. And, you know, we've seen a lot right now about the Supreme Court nomination coming up. And, you know, American voters will be voting also on a lot of Senate races. And the senators also have a huge influence in what laws we pass, who's held accountable. I mean, I think we can see right now Mitch McConnell is not holding President Trump accountable. The Republican senators are not holding President Trump accountable. And that's a huge part of the way that the American system is supposed to work. There's supposed to be a check on that power, and it's not functioning. So, you know, that also will be that's an important factor in what happens next and how those down ballot races turn out. And, you know, there's a lot of battleground states and there are a lot of offices right now where people aren't sitting too comfortable. So, you know, I don't think anything is certain.
Kevin, same question to you. If Trump wins, what?
I believe that there is guaranteed to be a certain amount of violence in the streets following Election Day. It's heartbreaking as an American to see my home country and see that there. I believe that there is going to be some kind of armed conflict during this period of uncertainty about the actual ballot count.
You're saying regardless of who wins?
Regardless of who wins, yes, because it seems almost guaranteed that because of when the mail-in ballot count begins, there is going to be some amount of uncertainty in at least a couple of states, I believe, and a sort of form of Bush v. Gore, I believe, will play out again. I think it's almost guaranteed that Trump will try to use litigation and sue possibly all 50 states over their election results. So I think no matter what happens, yes, there is guaranteed to be some amount of violence in the streets. If Trump is ultimately found to be the victor, personally, I don't see that as a totally unexpected outcome. Again, just because of gerrymandering, voter suppression laws, and people's general disinterest, I think. And I feel like that there are definitely voters out there who have a very difficult time distinguishing between the two. I know that sounds preposterous, but again, I've been to 48 U.S. states, and I can tell that that if there is one kind of white guy in his 70s, another white guy in his 70s, and their policies are not radically different in the same way that you know, somebody like Bernie Sanders might have brought, then I think a lot of people are actually just not going to vote. And to me, I think that's actually the greatest risk of this election.
Partha, how about you on that question?
See, I think it's quite likely that Trump will win, although the indicators suggest that he probably will not. But as the last panelist basically said, Trump has basically thrown the whole thing into like turmoil by saying that, like, you know, there's so much fraud in this, and the fact that the postal ballots will take some time to count is going to add to that confusion. Now, obviously, all of us were overconfident that Hillary Clinton was going to win in 2016. So it's important not to discount the real possibility that Trump might actually win. The other thing to keep in mind here is, right, there is a big difference between voters on the left and voters on the right. Voters on the right are extremely pragmatic. They are willing to overlook, for example, the evangelical vote and stuff. They're able to overlook all aspects of Trump's personal life as long as he delivers a conservative majority in the Supreme Court, right? And this recent unfortunate passing of RBG, it's unclear how it's going to affect the election. It might energize people on the left, but it might also energize people on the right, because Trump has delivered a conservative Supreme Court. And Trump, unless he changes the law and declares himself, like, you know, president for life and stuff, which, by the way, I can't completely rule out, his term is going to end in 4 years' time, worst case, right? But the Supreme Court people, especially, you know, you appoint somebody who's in their 40s and stuff, these people stay for like 3 or 4 generations, right? So the voters on the right are extremely pragmatic and they vote for goals and aims. The left, on the other hand, always is, you know, trying to find flaws with its own candidates. Like, Biden is not progressive enough. And Trump tried that yesterday, right? He tried to pin the, you don't have support the new, the Green New Deal and stuff. And Biden was a little weak there. He said, no, I don't support it. I support my plan for the environment and so on and so forth. So I think the problem is people on the left, or centrists or progressives, moderates, whatever, they also need to develop a sense of, you know, expediency. Don't vote for the perfect candidate. Vote for the better candidate of the two you have. So, you know, if you have two middle-aged, 70 plus old white men, vote for the 70 plus old white man who will do the right thing.
I see Trump's behavior as symptomatic of a deeper underlying problem. You know, and I call it the problem of the broken system of confidence in a common epistemic foundation. Others, like Ezra Levant, for example, have identified it in terms of identity politics. So there's a kind of realignment. Others have referred to it as a problem of ideological incoherence. There are a lot of ways to come at this. It's complex. But obviously, I'm deeply, deeply troubled by what Trump is doing.
Okay, but let me just, for argument's sake, throw the argument that I hear from the other side at you, which is, you know, that's just Donald being Donald. He's just mouthing off. He's just trying to get the press's dander going. And, of course, if he loses, he'll leave. What's your response to that?
My response to that is that if you had a healthy, vibrant civic culture, I wouldn't be as worried about it. The problem is we don't. And that's where the whole issue of heroic citizenship really comes into the piece. And I'm so thrilled that we've got three of my heroes on this panel with us as living, breathing examples of what I'm talking about. But what you need to have is a society that responds to that kind of behavior, so that when you have a wild autocrat like that, making those kinds of threats and, in fact, weaponizing the disenchantment in his base, you really have to be worried, not because of what he's doing, but because the rest of us aren't sufficiently educated and conditioned to respond.
Those three heroes of yours are still to come. They're standing by. I'd like you to broaden the lens, if you would, and tell us what other countries in the world you think are particularly at risk for the phenomenon you're describing.
Well, I think every democracy is, even our own. And I don't know that I'll have time to come to it. They're all the obvious ones that have, you know, officially defined themselves as illiberal. Orbán's Hungary, Erdogan's Turkey, Kaczynski's Poland. But, you know, even in Canada, we've begun to, you know, Canada, which is still something of a refuge in the storm of populism and of right-wing populism, still is susceptible to all of this, because ultimately we're in now a populist moment where facts are no longer the essential building blocks of our discourse. You know, we're motivated by other considerations, and our leaders and political masters now speak to us not so much appealing to our reason, but speaking to our identification with certain groups That's a very, very dangerous trend. So we're susceptible to it here. And I'll just finish with one thing that I think we now realize is true. Democracy is neither inevitable nor immortal. Democracies die. They always have. So the effort to redeem the promise of liberal democracy is not an obvious one. And it's not going to happen by any sort of simple fix. We have to understand the complexities at work here. And then we have to have the courage, the fortitude, and the resources and to then address them. And it's a tough and not an obvious undertaking.
Peter, one more before we get your friends involved, and that is this. We had the Harvard philosopher Michael Sandel on the program last week, and he suggested that, you know, people on the center left, with their focus on credentialism, has led to a hubris among this group in our society, and even worse, a humiliation of those who don't have that kind of credentialism. I think he described it as one of the last kinds of prejudice or discrimination that's actually allowed in our society. Is the discrimination against those who have less education than others. And, you know, and he notes that the so-called deplorables are now seeking their revenge. Do you acknowledge that progressive people are partially responsible for the predicament democracies now find themselves in?
Progressive people are just as responsible as everyone else for it. They're just as susceptible to this resort to identity politics and to virtue signaling rather than to real engagement across partisan, ideological, cultural, and socioeconomic lines. Michael Sandel is absolutely right. Michael Sandel is also known for something, another insight that is absolutely vitally important to this entire discussion, and that is when he puts on his communitarian hat and identifies liberal democracy as being deficient in that it provides no conception of the good life, of community, and therefore leads to what I refer to as a kind of social cohesion deficit. And credentialism certainly is a problem and certainly justifies resentment on the part of the less well-credentialed. There's no question about that. I'm not sure that Michael presents the same sort of solution that I would to that problem, but I absolutely acknowledge his insight on that.
That's just some of what we covered this week on The Agenda. For more, including the complete conversations, you can always visit our website, tvo.org, our YouTube channel at youtube.com/theagenda, or our Twitter feed, twitter.com/theagenda.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is brought to you by the Chartered Professional Accountants of Ontario. CPA Ontario is a regulator, an educator, a thought leader, and an advocate. We protect the public. We advance our profession. We guide our CPAs. We are CPA Ontario. And by viewers like you. Thank you.